This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. You can get even more reviews, discussions, and recommendations on the True Crime Tip by signing up today at bestevidence.fyi. And now, the episode.
Here. Keller's mom, the detective who interviewed her, Connor James.
Who gives a fuck?
I do. I give many fucks.
CBS All Access dips a toe into true crime with Interrogation, in which an all-star cast tangles with a questionable conviction, and viewers get to choose their own cold case adventure, sort of. Speaking of cold cases, ours is about a law school podcast episode on Hugh Burton, the man whose case may have inspired Interrogations. We're putting the order back in Law & Order on The Bladder Presents, episode 131. That pun was probably just as confusing as Interrogation's raison d'etre. Anyway, welcome back to The Bladder Presents, where we talk about how true crime is told and sold. I don't have to sell you on my guest, the estimable Toby Ball. Oh my God.
That's a mouthful.
That was too many M's and B's for someone with a cold. Hello again, Toby.
Hey, I'm sorry you have a cold.
Yeah, well, it's February. Shit happens.
You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were really surprised that we had never met in person.
I feel like this has come up before.
Has it?
Yeah.
For me?
I mean, I guess it is a little surprising, given that, you know, you live on my roof and all.
That's true. You think we would just...
You think we'd cross paths at some point.
Yeah. Well... Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off.
Well, if you're that reluctant to actually talk about Interrogation, not sure what that says, but our most wanted topic today is Interrogation, which dropped in its entirety on CBS All Access the end of last week. This is a little unusual for an All Access product. They tend to stick to the once a week model. Here's the case file from the landing page. Interrogation is a true crime series based on a case that spans more than 20 years in which a young man was charged and convicted of brutally murdering his mother. After being sentenced to life in prison, he continued to fight to prove his innocence. With all episodes dropping at once, viewers will see the day of the crime and then follow the evidence like a cold case detective, abandon the linear narrative, and determine their own investigative path by watching the episodes leading up to the finale in any order. Okay.
No, they won't.
I've seen the whole thing.
Oh my God.
I assume that you have not.
No.
How many of these did you watch? I know you watched the first one.
I saw two.
Okay. What did you go with for the second one?
Chris.
Okay. So
the kind of his like the roommate.
Yeah. So is that the next one in, because they put them in a certain order?
No, it's not. So if you take a look at like the grid,
right,
it's right below the first one. It's not like if you're reading across.
Okay.
It was right below. But I think in the first one, at least for me, it seemed like the obvious next person to look at was Chris, because at the end they kind of tease it.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, I guess I'll check this out.
I think that's actually
what I did.
Episode 5, and we do have a bunch of clips from that. But basically, they have it, there's 10 episodes, they have it in a certain order. I read one review where the reviewer just like randomized the numbers and watched them that way, which is one way to do it. You can also watch it in the suggested order, which is sort of a flashback structure. I went chronologically, and I forget what order that means. I think after episode 1, chronologically, you actually jump back in time, and that's episode 3 or 4. I don't think it makes a ton of difference, because in the finale, there is a payoff of sorts that I think the show wants you to believe that this is the suggested solution. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, like, when you go back and think about how everything was acted by everyone else involved, it doesn't hold up. I think the show wants you to believe that this is the solution, and then it just doesn't work. I don't want to spoil too much of it for people who haven't watched the whole thing yet, but I urge you, listeners who have watched the whole thing, to give me a shout at Blotter Presents on Twitter or anywhere else. We actually have a voicemail, 919-75-CRIME. Please call and rant about how it does or does not work for you. If you would like, you can also text that number. That's 919-75-CRIME. Would you be inclined, if you had time, which no one does, to continue watching this and see how it winds through the investigation?
I don't think so, quite honestly.
Why is that?
Were you excited to watch the whole thing?
I was excited is not the right word.
putting it a little strongly.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to understand, like, I, as you do for Crime Writers On, have to download like entire series and synthesize them like every week. And yeah. I'm tired. So, I was not enthused by the prospect of 10 episodes, but I was intrigued. First of all, I don't know if you were a Veronica Mars watcher.
I don't have the first clue about it.
Okay. The lead in this, the guy who's playing the guy who was convicted, Kyle Gallner played, spoiler, I guess, this season has been out for 16 years now, everybody get over it, a killer in season 2 of Veronica Mars, and one that you didn't necessarily know his level of involvement as the season was going on, so he is experienced at playing just a, like, opaque, kind of ambiguous performance that when you go back to it, it makes sense. So I thought he was a good choice for this.
Although he's, assuming he wasn't 2 years old when he did Veronica Mars.
Yeah, no, he's...
He must be way older than 17.
Yeah, he's not 17. He's okay. 33. And I think it is unwise of the series to hang the light that it does on the fact that he is 17 at the time that this crime occurs. Here's clip two.
Steely Dan, right? Fusion bullshit. Sounds like crazy.
You gotta be 18.
I will be soon. Okay, and I'm a really hard worker.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like, whatever.
We get it. Here's the interesting thing is that they could have, I mean, he could almost pass for, like, he's 33 in real life. I would give you 23. So why not move all of the circumstances of this up by 5 years and then have Kyle Gallner play him at this age, and then have Hawks, John Hawks from Deadwood, oh, yeah. Winter's Bone,
Mary, Marcy, Marlene, yes. Whatever that one was. That was an awesome movie.
Yeah. And I feel they could be father and son.
Yeah. So the question that you asked me is, would I watch it again, watch more of it? And, you know, there's a bunch of reasons why I don't think I would. And I mean, we can go through them one by one, but it's the first thing I think, and I don't know what you thought. I mean, you watched the whole thing, but the whole sort of, you know, do it in the order you want to do it. It just seems like such a false premise because it all ends up at the same ending.
Yeah.
There's no consequence for choices you make. And you get, like, after every choice you do make, you get fewer and fewer choices until the end when you don't have any choice. There's one left. So
yeah,
it's not really, you're not really choosing much of anything other than just the order in which you watch all these episodes. But it's not like if you choose one, then three, then six, that the ending is going to be any different.
Yeah. And so the ending is sort of equally, like, I can't imagine how the ending would feel any more satisfying if I had changed the order in which I watched it. I don't know. I mean,
yeah. This, so it just seemed like the whole thing, like, if you're going to do that, like, I don't think it's a bad idea. And if the idea is that you're going to be like, here, we're going to do as much as we possibly can to, like, put you in the, you know, put you in the seat, let you kind of drive things. And I know, like, I think doing it in 45-minute episodes and having 10 of them probably isn't the way to do it. But it seems to me that you could do, you know, 15 or 20-minute episodes and really have different, you know, different paths you can go, which doesn't necessarily mean you're going to see everything, but would have, you know, would leave you with different impressions. I think it would be complicated. I think it would be hard. But if you're doing it on, like, I don't know if this stuff, obviously, it's not going to be able to make it to the normal CBS, right? It's never going to be a week by week.
Right.
So it seemed like you have a chance to do something kind of inventive and actually have consequences for what you decide to do next.
Right.
And how you decide kind to pursue
things. Kind of like, I mean, kind of like that Black Mirror episode where you did have options for, like, play. Like, it is more like a video game, or like that old, there used to be a Perry Mason, like, text, like, video game for the, whatever, the Apple III, because I'm a million years old. We played it on a wax tablet. Ask your grandparents.
There you go.
But it this way, it's sort of like, I mean, in theory, the way that these are labeled by time, first of all, there's sometimes flashbacks within something that is labeled like 2003 or 2005. Like, there's still flashbacks in it, which, okay. But in theory, you could watch any show in any order that drops all at once, right? Like, unless there's something in there that, like, you have to unlock B by watching A, and you can't just jump to the finale, and there's no real solving element. Like, you're given the solution. So,
I mean, it's like watching reruns of a sitcom, right?
Yeah.
Like, there might be some through narrative, but for the most part, each one, you learn more about their character or something like that. But, you know, you don't have to watch them in order. You can watch Seinfeld's or The Office or whatever in any order you want, and you don't lose very much.
Yeah. And there are certain sort of serialized detective show seasons that you can also watch kind of out of order. And it's like, all right, do you need all of this information? Not necessarily. I mean, I think 10 episodes was too long. I understand that part of what they were trying to do was show, like, if you watch it chronologically, there is this sort of longtime companion feeling to it where, as you're going along, people are dropping out of the narrative because they've died. CBS makes a big point of, like, pretty much every character who's shown smoking is given COPD and, like, lengthy, poor David Strathairn is having to play this, like, wheezy.
Oh, God.
These wheezy scenes in jail. But like, 8 episodes is like, and seriously, everyone is in this. Strathairn is in it. Gallner, who I think, you know, Veronica Mars people will know. I'm not sure what else he's been up to in the interim.
Sarsgaard,
Frank Whaley, Andre Royo and Sonia Sohn from The Wire, and of course, Detective Bobby Gorin, good old Denofrionix at work. He's quite good in this. That guy who played Desi on Girls, which I'd given up on Girls by that time, but that guy's a good actor. He's in it. Sprague Graydon is in it. It was like a just a waste of like a lot of name talent who were quite good in it. And just CBS kind of being like, this is a CBS procedural, except it's more like a video game and everybody gets to use swears. Like, okay. All the performances are good, but having watched the whole thing, it's kind of like the one thing that you should have made sure worked was your ending after all of that.
I didn't watch enough to see all those actors pop up, but I thought, you know, even with Strathairn and Sarsgaard, who are both good actors, I thought the characters were very shallowly written. There's at no point that I felt sorry or angry or anything about anybody.
Right.
It just, you know, Sarsgaard, you know, he's a good actor, and his character is just like, I have the foggiest idea what this guy's like. I mean, he's just a cop and he has a hunch.
Yeah.
And he does like cop stuff in these interrogations, but it's exactly what you'd expect from a network TV cop. Like there's nothing interesting about his character. There's nothing interesting. And I, again, maybe they get more into this, but when I was watching like the second episode, the one about this guy, Chris. So Strathairn is the father of, you know, it's the husband of the woman who was murdered. He goes to see where his son was living. And it's this absolute hovel that's just like so over the top that it's just, you know, it's nuts. But to me, the idea that he didn't understand, despite the fact that he lived just a few miles from his son, that these were the conditions that he was living in, like that to me seems like a big plot point and a big pathology, which at least in the first two episodes, they do not even hint at being an issue other than that the kid's a little bit estranged.
Well, they definitely get into that more in subsequent episodes where you're learning about his relationship with his mother and that he was adopted and that the mom was definitely more willing to set a bottom line and stick to it with her addict son. But it was also like, you also have to sort of take it on faith that parents would have gotten him an apartment when he was 17 and been like, you can keep being a junkie and we'll pay for it. Just don't have it in our home. Like,
yeah.
that kind of felt not organic or believable. And
it's more believable than him leaving the apartment and then like walking by an open door where some woman's like smoking crack with her baby watching television and he's watching her through the open door and then he gets to leave and some big kind of bully guy is like, what are you looking at?
Yeah, you got a problem?
It's like, and he's like bumbles away.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, so in the 30 seconds you're on this landing, you got the full spectrum of hideousness that your son has been living in. It just, I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder.
It seemed poorly written.
I just wonder who some of it is for, because if the point, like the sort of overarching point is that, and this is something that you and I, because we marinate in this kind of material, understand, is that interrogations, particularly ones undertaken with youthful offenders, are not sufficient evidence by themselves. Like a confession that is wrung from some strung out 17-year-old is not, can't stand alone, because juries will believe it whether or not they understand the context of what's going on. So if the show is trying to give the usual CBS viewer, who was even older than my ass, like a primer on why certain kinds of evidence can't be trusted, I think this is, believe it or not, too subtle. All right, let me play another clip from the first episode in which the detective Sarsgaard, like, this is his first case where he's the lead detective. He's very motivated to solve it. He has a gut feeling, and he's pretty good at not overplaying this idea that, like, this is his motivation. And also, at this point in the narrative, we're still kind of on his side. Here's clip three.
Polygraph.
Yeah, well, we can't ask him. He's got to volunteer. His daddy's going to think it's a good idea.
If he hasn't given it up yet, he's not going to.
Because you don't think he did it?
Everyone thinks he did it.
Mm-hmm. Here we go.
But that's not the job. If you don't get the cop out, it's circumstantial. Gotta put a case together, do the work.
I know that he killed her, and he knows that he killed her.
Then let him sweat it, soak in it. Come back out with me, help me work the scene.
He needs to get this off his chest now. I can feel it. All right, you got a cigarette?
No, I do not.
Because you quit?
Mm-hmm.
You don't got one on you?
Go fuck yourself.
How did I know that? It's because I could feel it.
I mean, I'm sort of interested in watching maybe if they'd structured it differently and like each episode was sort of like a longitudinal study of various relationships between characters. Like, I would have watched an episode about Lieutenant Whaley and Detective Sarsgaard's like evolving professional relationship. It does do some things well. I'm just not.
Oh, that's Whaley?
Huh?
I didn't realize that was Whaley, but now that you're mentioning it, I do know who that is.
Yeah.
Man, he's old.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Sorry. I'm sorry I interrupted. It was just like a revelation. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
No, not at all. This is what I'm saying. You have a lot of good actors in this who are used to playing this material. Whaley kind of has a whole sideline now playing cops of various sorts, I feel like he's been showing up a lot in my viewing as, you know, a lieutenant. There's an essential failure to really understand what they're trying to do, I think. Like, does that make any sense? Like, I just feel like they could be making a point about interrogations of adolescents leading to wrongful convictions, but I don't think that's the main part of what they're trying to do. They could be trying to upend the procedural genre, but they're doing it wrong. So I'm not sure why we're here, basically.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I can think of examples of things that aren't completely analogous to it, but have aspects of it. So I don't know if you watched, I think it was called Criminal, that one where they had like four in the UK and four in Germany and four in France and four in Spain. Did you see that?
Mm-mm.
It was just a straight ahead interrogation show. So I just watched, we for Crime Writers, we did the one from Britain. But essentially the whole thing, like if it's 25 minutes long or whatever, 20 minutes of it is in the interrogation room having an interrogation. And, you know, there's an intensity to it. You know, you can tell what the stakes are. The acting's really good. And there's sort of a, you know, there's kind of a cat and mouse aspect to it where these cops are trying to ascertain what happened. Like they have some basic facts, but they don't know what happened. And through sort of clever questioning and not, you know, there's like a little bit of trying to use intimidation or psychology at different times, but it's really, how can I elicit from you information that you might not want to give me?
Right.
Over the course of a period of time. And that gives us this intensity to those situations. So, I mean, it wasn't a perfect show. And my understanding is that I think the German one was supposed to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that the interrogation scenes in this were absolutely lacking in intensity. It was, you know, it didn't seem like much was at stake at all.
Well,
they weren't filmed in such a way.
There really isn't anything because you've already been told by the show's like sort of landing page materials and promotional materials that this guy is in jail for a crime he didn't commit. So all you're sort of looking at is like, you're looking at the road to how this happened. But again, for people like you and me who, like, I've watched the confession tapes. I've watched The Wrong Man. We know that this happened. Making a Murderer, like, everybody watched that. Right. We know that this happens. So,
right.
There is a lack of suspense, but it does seem concerned with showing us how this happened and how a detective can manipulate a teenager into getting the information he wants. Skipping ahead to clip 5, this is from the Chris Keller episode, and this is him sort of nudging Chris Keller towards, like, he turns off the tape recorder and he's like, when I come back, you need to be telling me something that doesn't implicate you and implicates the guy I like for it. Here's clip 5.
That's why I came back here.
Friday, the day after the murder. Okay, we're going off tape. This interview with Christopher Keller is concluded. It is 5:07 Mountain Time. Everything you've just told me does more to implicate you in this crime than to rule you out. So I need names, places, times, checkable facts. You better pray that you checked into that motel at 11. Good, I got your attention. When I come back, checkable fucking facts.
Like, I mean, okay. Got it. But then later in that same episode, Lieutenant Whaley has to give Detective Sarsgaard a lecture that's like, you have to work the case and not only look for facts that fit your theory.
Right.
And he's like, Fisher did this. But then the show doesn't really ever get into how culpable Lieutenant Whaley is for kind of allowing this to happen. I will give it this. The actor playing Chris Keller is really good and is sort of both like frail and pitiable and methy and scary. And the only time that I laughed was in clip 4. Here it is.
Sometime that morning, 11 maybe.
$5 for the key, refundable, 21 for the room, 26 total.
26.
11 a.m. You're sure about that? You checked in at 11 on March 10th, day of the murder.
Thanks, Jack.
Young and Restless starts at 11, so.
You need some more champagne.
The Young and the Restless.
Just fucking kiss her already. Used to watch it with my mom.
I mean, I was a soap watcher. I will give them this also. In this sequence, they are showing The Young and the Restless. It is, I'm pretty sure, from 1983, 1984, because I used to watch it. And when he slaps the money down on the counter, it is currency consistent with the 80s. I am the only person who cares about that shit, but I enjoy it when the props department cares about it also.
You know what I care about is the font on newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Because I used to work in a newspaper clip room.
Right.
That was my first job. So I like 75 newspapers from around the country. So if somebody has a fake Times-Picayune or, you know, whatever, Oregonian, I'm on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can always spot the dummy text or like, really? We're going sans serif in the body of the article? Yeah, that
right.
Right there with you.
So I guess my other thoughts were, one, what's the name of the son?
Oh, the actual guy?
No, the character.
Oh, my God. I can't remember. Thinking of everyone with their...
As their actor names?
Eric Fisher, and Jesus. Oh,
Eric
but,
Fisher.
Excuse me, everywhere else it's Fisher, like someone who fishes, and then there's a chyron at some point about the dad, Henry Fisher, that's David Strathairn, who, and they spell it with a C anyway. Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, he is so freaking out of control all the time for the two episodes I saw. Like, I've literally never seen anyone ever act that way over the age of like 4.
Right.
I mean, he's just full on screaming, a raving lunatic the entire time. Unless he's like sniveling and sniffing. And I mean, it's just, it's nuts.
You didn't think that was a product of whatever speed or coke or whatever? You thought that was bad direction?
Well, I think eventually you come down. Like,
yeah.
I mean, he's keeping that going for a few days. And then, I don't know. My overall thing, I turned it on. I was like, wow, is this going to be CBS's, like, having it go at sort of an HBO or Showtime style, higher brow, prestige.
Right, prestige, thing. Totally.
And we've got these actors and, obviously spent a lot of money on it. And then it's all put towards like absolutely, like I don't watch a whole lot of network TV, but, it's directed just like a network TV show.
Yeah, there is a lot of
set up that way.
Yeah.
It just looks like something you'd watch on like Thursday at 9.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And so there's also a lot of deeply conventional choices. Like we all know the struggles that the average televised prisoner faces. And then there's one, like he gets married at some point while he's in prison, and he's having a conjugal visit, and they're fucking, and you see Gallner's ass, and it's like,
ooh,
it's fine, it's a perfectly fine ass, congratulations, Gallner family, but it's like, why is this happening? To show that you can show some butts, because grandmas aren't going to know how to get to CBS All Access and they're not watching, and you could say things like motherfucker a whole lot. Like,
yeah,
I just am not sure. And the thing is, The Good Fight understands how to use the freedom of what it can do correctly. Like, the cursing feels, and like I curse a lot, so for me to be like, this cursing feels organic, like that means it's really not. So The Good Fight knows how to do that. The Good Fight knows how to like play with run times a little more to use the extra like 10 minutes that it gets to actually say something else instead of just being like, well, we can be an hour and 7 minutes. Fuck you guys. Like, this, I think, was a good idea that whoever was in charge of it kind of couldn't get past predictable, like, here's the part where he has to get jumped out of the prison gang, and here's the part where his prison wife is like, I'm, leaving you for someone who's not in jail, and here's the part where, he bricks his parole hearing because he saw Shawshank Redemption too many times, and he still hasn't dealt with his rage issues, and blah, blah, blah. Like, there were just choices made that you could see coming, and it's not obviously rough in state prison in California, especially if you didn't do what you're accused of doing, but narratively you can't be spending 12 minutes on that. So did you have any other formal objections to file on this?
No, I think the prosecution rests.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. It's one of those things where, like, during it, I was happy to see these actors and I was interested to see where it was going to go. And like seeing Vincent D'Onofrio try not to do the Law and Order Criminal Intent ticks is interesting. And also, he's just like this massive pile of actor now with this like leonine hair. I mean, I love D'Onofrio. He's great. But I don't know. It just, every now and then he seemed to like sneak a look at the camera like, Oh, is this what I'm doing now? I don't know. Anyway, listeners, let us know what you thought. Let us know if you got partway through it and were kind of waiting to see what we thought, and now you're going to bail on it. And especially if you watched the whole thing, let me know if you agree with me that episode 10 was some bullshit. Let's move on to the cold case. The interrogation producers have been super cagey about which real life case this is based on, probably so that it would not invite unflattering comparisons to interrogation. I forget how I sort of figured out that this was probably the guy. I think I just threw a whole bunch of search terms in Google and this was the only name that came up. But we are contemplating a podcast from Rutgers University Law School called The Power of Attorney. This episode is from last year. It's episode 4. Here's the case file. Produced by Rutgers Law School, The Power of Attorney, quote, is an inside look at the power of legal education. Other episodes have covered everything from entertainment law to antitrust law and big pharma to starting your own practice when you're fresh off the bar exam. This episode, like I said, dropped in October of last year, and on Apple Podcasts, it is described thusly. Co-dean David Lopez speaks with exoneree Hugh Burton and Rutgers Law professor Laura Cohen about the failures of our criminal justice system and what it's like to be wrongfully imprisoned. Hugh Burton, I believe, was paroled for the murder of his mother. He was paroled in 2009. I think he'd done 20 years. And then he was fully exonerated like 10 years after that. Now he was on a segment of Real Sports because he had been gotten really into running, ironically, and was sort of trying to finish the New York City Marathon. And he ran it with Professor Laura Cohen, who she and her students and their Innocence Project were working on his case. This pod is aurally a little rough. What'd you think of this episode, Toby?
You know, working at a university, I feel like I see like their presentations that are like this, you know, fairly frequently.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed very familiar. I mean, it was interesting. It was mostly stuff I feel like I already kind of knew about, you know, false confessions and
yeah.
And, you know, interrogation techniques and how they are especially insidious against teenagers for a variety of sort of maturity and, you know, I don't know, what is it, the frontal cortex?
Yeah, like just neurologically, they're not ready to go toe-to-toe with a detective. So, yeah.
So, you know, If you don't know much about that stuff, I think it's a pretty well organized, pretty clear explanation of all that stuff. I was a little surprised how little it had to do with the actual guy.
Yeah,
it was really talking in generalities about stuff that had specifically affected him. But the larger concern seems to be, you know, the practice that law enforcement uses in these interrogations.
And also how Innocence Projects, which are often staffed by like 2 and 3 L's and, you know, law students, how like whole generations of law students have passed through still working on this case. You know, it's a law school podcast, so that's understandable. But I think they missed an opportunity not talking to actual Hugh Burton more since he's in the room.
Right.
The first clip in this section is Lopez asking Burton if he, you know, how he sort of kept his spirits up and did he always have hope that this conviction would be overturned, and the promptness of Burton's response sort of made me laugh. Burton has a very pleasant voice and should consider narrating audiobooks, but he speaks a little low. He's not mic'd very well. So you might want to turn the volume up just a little bit for clip 7.
And during the period of time when you were incarcerated, I would imagine that was a pretty hopeless situation. Or were there moments when you felt hope? Did you always have hope?
No. I mean, you continue to press on because it's what you have to do. But through parole denials, through appeals not being granted, you kind of have this feeling like, is it ever going to end? You know you're innocent, but is it going to end? So there are days that are better than others, where you really have a sense of hope, and then there's other days where you don't feel too sure that it's going to happen. So
this is one thing that Interrogation did do fairly well, I felt, was indicate, maybe not in the casting and with some of the wig work, alas, but this feeling that, you know, months and years can go by between like even the littlest movement with it, and sort of how hard it is to, like, you can't just sort of think about this and nothing but this every second, or keep, you know, stay positive about it. So I thought that was an interesting insight, and just how quickly he was like, no, some days right. really sucked. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I kind of wish, as someone who's advocated for doing podcasty type things at the universities I've worked at, I feel like having the you know, associate dean or whoever that was doing the interviewing, I think was a bad choice.
Yeah.
I wish they'd maybe had one of the law students who'd worked on it do the interviewing, because I did get the feeling there are a few moments where it seemed like this was clearly like an advertisement for Rutgers Law School,
right?
In ways that I found kind of distasteful. Like at one point he's like, "Do you have anything to say to all these people who worked for your freedom?"
Yeah, like, that was a little.
That's like,
what's he gonna? What's he supposed what do you think say? He's gonna say? Also, like, that's just bad. That's just bad tape, yeah. As your friend of mine would say. Like, well, I'd like to tell them to eat a bee. Like, what do you think he's going to say, dude? Also, and, he was out already. Not for nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, the other thing would be just having somebody who had a little more investment in the whole process. Again, I feel like this guy, for as much as he's probably interested in and is proud of the people who worked on it, having somebody who actually did work on it, I think would have been... We've had a little more insightful questions.
Well, or have the dean interview Laura Cohen, and then have Laura Cohen just have a conversation, like, because she worked on it and she is in the room, and they ran the fucking marathon together, like, more than once, I think.
Right.
So that you know, that's a friends for life situation, I think. And she. I mean, she definitely is like, she's a professor at this law school. This is her boss. And she's also an attorney a litigator, I presume, who is very used to answering questions in this orotund, complete paragraphs way. That's, you know, a very clear delineation of the issues that you're discussing, which I think was good. But then I think you have to mediate that somewhat with the actual person to whom this happened. And, like, I don't know. Like, I get that he's not an attorney, but it just didn't quite... Like, if you're going to have him in the room... Do more with him and with his perspective, or don't, because you're a law school podcast, and if he's not a law student, then it's actually okay to just talk about him, right? So,
no, I agree. I absolutely 100% agree that it was like, why, like, beyond just having the guy who they were working on his case there in the room, what were they looking for him to contribute?
Yeah.
And I think the answer was they weren't looking for him for very much
gratitude. You know? I think probably
they threw him a few things and were like, you know, can you talk about this? Can you talk about that? But for the most part, you know, it was the law professor talking.
Yeah,
and again, I mean, she was. It's an interesting, like, again, if you want a quick one, if you want to spend 45 minutes or an hour and find out a lot of stuff about this, that if you don't know much about it, like, this is a good sort of quick course.
Yeah.
In those issues.
And she, it was a little hard, again, attorneys, it was a little hard to get like a short enough clip of her sort of explaining why it is that, you know, how this came to be in terms of just like the paperwork processes, how they came to be involved in his case. And then also what the stakes were in terms of reversing years and decades of received wisdom about what the confession of a 17-year-old who may have been on drugs is worth. I think I distilled it down in clip 8, and here's that.
So they're presented with two choices. They either confess in a way that shows them at their absolute worst with no moral grounding, or they're offered an excuse that creates a moral justification for this horrible act to which they are about to confess. The third option, I didn't do it, is not made available to them. Children and adolescents who are at a moment in time when they are developing personally and grasping for, searching for their moral identity, are very vulnerable to being given that false dichotomy and are going to try to grasp at whatever it is that makes them seem like the better human being.
I thought that was a really good insight and a way of putting this that I had never heard before. She goes on to talk about the role of peer pressure and how detectives can use that against adolescents. She talks about how consequences in the far term are like, basically, it's just not something that an adolescent can process.
Right. I just want to go home and sleep in my bed.
Yeah. So if they're told like, okay, well, I'm going to tell the DA that he should let you go home, what the adolescent hears is, great, then I'll just say what I have to say to get out of the situation, not understanding all the ifs baked into that statement. And like how hard it is to turn the ship of, you know, once arraignments start happening and indictments start happening. So I thought that was a really interesting take on it, just to say like, I didn't do it is not an option that they're offered, and they can't really think past the options that they've been presented. So, you know, she's very cogent. And if you don't actually have a lot of background in this particular like subgenre of like wrongful conviction studies or whatever, this is good. But we'll have some stuff in the show notes about Hugh Burton's actual story.
You know, the one thing I was thinking about while I was listening to this in the car today was how things have changed, because Homicide, the book by David Simon, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of detail about these interrogations, and I guess maybe they're not with juveniles, but it's using the same stuff against guys and really pressuring to get manipulating people, lying to them, all this stuff to get people to confess. And it's kind of put forward, I don't know if it's like approving is exactly the right word, but at best it's non-judgmental.
Right.
But I think he does sort of like these cops. And you know, I feel like David Simon and my politics are probably very similar based on his Twitter account.
Right.
But it is kind of interesting that, you know, 30 years later, I can't remember exactly when that book came out, You know, things have really changed in how we take a look at that stuff. And instead of being, you know, tough on crime and this is what you got to do to get criminals to confess and things like that, it's more, you know, what's the collateral damage here?
Yeah.
You know, who are you actually putting in jail with these techniques?
Right. And who aren't you catching?
Yeah.
When you decide, like, in order to put down this case, in order to, as, you know, they would have said in the book, in order to get rid of a, you know, cross a red ball off the board, that if someone tells you they did it, it's like, well, great. No further questions. Like, okay, well, you
and I think
better hope that's right.
He does talk about how, like, the more, like, the career criminals all know the game.
Right.
And you can't get them. So it's like you're really, the people you can get are the new guys.
Yeah.
You know, the other guys, you know, they just know to keep their mouth shut.
Yeah. She goes on to recommend some other materials. She's asked specifically by Dean Lopez what she would recommend if people are interested in this line of inquiry. And she recommends Making a Murderer, which I believe someone affiliated with Rutgers Law School was also affiliated with that. Steve Drizin. I'm not sure of the relationship.
Because he was the one who brought the actually Hughes case to Rutgers Law School.
Okay.
He got in touch with that professor and was like, hey, there's this case in New York. Are you interested? And she said, yes. So he was involved in that way.
And then she talks for a while about why Brendan Dassey's confession was so problematic for a bunch of reasons, in addition to just adolescent prefrontal cortex stuff. She also recommends Brian Stevenson's book, which I think was turned into both a podcast and a documentary on HBO recently.
And there's a movie in the theater.
Yes, starring
Savage Grace.
Yeah, starring Michael Jordan, Michael B. Jordan from,
I think,
actually,
right.
The Wire also. So, yeah, it always comes back to The Wire. Bubbles, Kima Gregg, the guy who played Cuddy are all in Interrogation. So if for no other reason, it was worth some of your time.
You know, when we were watching... When my wife and I were watching The Wire, which was years after it first came out, we were actually flying back from my my grandfather's memorial service from Baltimore up to either Manchester or Boston. I can't remember which. And she was sitting next to the woman who played Kima.
Oh, nice.
And had no idea. Oh. And they talked the entire time. They talked every minute of the flight. And then I was like, what were you talking about? Were you talking about The Wire? She's like, why would I talk to her about The Wire? I was like, because that was Kima.
Oh, man.
That's what I would have talked to her about.
Seriously. Or I would have sat there, like, rigid, trying to be cool.
She had no idea. They were just talking about just stuff.
Hmm.
You know? So anyway, she said she was super nice.
Well, that's awesome. I'm really glad to hear that. The Power of Attorney, I think, is a... I think it's actually a pretty informative podcast. I do wish that they would get an undergrad to, like, cope with the sound quality, because, you know, it's 2020 and it's time. Says the woman whose dog was barking hysterically for like 10 minutes at the beginning of this podcast.
Back when I was teaching high school, I would 100% have assigned that podcast, as homework, rather than having somebody read stuff about that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's very clear, you know.
Yeah.
it's a good little summary of the issues.
And I think if you're sort of interested in not like the practice of law, but like the in practiceness of law, there's a lot of different episodes about all different topics. Like I said, there's even one about quote space law and like how to get involved with sort of legalities of NASA, but this episode underused actual Hugh Burton, given that they were talking about his story. And David Simon product, still reliable and better than most of the stuff that's new. Would you say that's a fair summary of our conversation?
Yes. Yep.
All right.
We talked about a lot of David Simon today.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. And I'm never mad about it. No. Maybe the next time you're on, we should just watch The Corner.
In local news today, bees. Mm-hmm.
Toby, where else can the listeners find you?
Every Monday morning, you can catch me on Crime Writers On podcast on every freaking podcast app there is. On our Patreon site, I do the Deep Dive Book Club, which, as everybody knows, Sarah's been on many times. The most recent book we did was called Savage Appetites by Rachel Monroe. Have you read that?
Yeah, we talked about it a few episodes ago with Kevin Smokler.
Oh, did you like it?
I did like it. I thought that there were like a couple of parts that I was like, this feels like we're maybe padding for page count or straining for connections. Absolutely. But I thought it was super thought provoking and there was a lot to talk about. So yeah, I liked it a lot.
And then next month we're doing Adnan's story by Ravia Chaudhry. So that'll be fun. And on the Twitters, I'm at TobyBallNH. And we have a official Crime Writers On discussion group Facebook page. And I guess that's probably about it.
All right. You said a mouthful. Thanks for coming back on.
Hey, always a pleasure.
I'll try to pick something better and shorter next time.
Yeah, this was kind of I was kind of psyched to check out but it ended up being kind of meh.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of those that, like, you don't realize it's meh until you get to the end, and then you're like, God damn it, that's 10 hours. Anyway.
Right. You're not getting them back.
No, I'm not. And neither, listener, are you. But here's what's coming up on The Blotter Presents. Jeb Lund is coming back to talk about The Pharmacist, plus a vintage Jeffrey McDonald documentary. And after that, who knows? There's a lot of recent material to catch up on, because for some reason, true crime producers are just dropping everything in 3 weeks at the end of January and beginning of February. But if you've got a preference or a rant, you can call me or text me, 919-75-CRIME. Until then, if you've got any other tips for The Blotter Presents, I'm on social media, Blotter Presents, on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. My guest has been Toby Ball, and he's on Twitter at TobyBallNH, like he said. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.